Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 21st, 2020, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is How to Think, Not What to Think. This is an SGEM Extra episode. I had the honor of presenting at the Department of Family Medicine's Grand Rounds at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry on October 7th, 2020. The title of the talk was How to Think, Not What to Think. There were five objectives to the talk. The first one was to discuss what is science, and then talk about who has the burden of proof. We also discussed one of my favorite topics, evidence-based medicine, some of the limitations, and alternatives to evidence-based medicine. And then I presented a five-step approach to critical appraisal, and at the end briefly talked about COVID-19 and the importance of evidence-based medicine. The presentation is available on YouTube, so you can watch it with slides, and all of my slides will be available to download for free. The Skeptic's Guide has over 4,300 subscribers, and it's translated into four other languages. And the overall theme is to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if I taught you, with the ultimate goal of patients getting the best care based on the best evidence. My personal disclosures is that I have a patent on a pediatric resuscitation board that I developed with my son when he was 16 years old. I think we got it. It was his grade 10 science fair project. And eventually he won the bronze medal in Canada for Canadian-wide science fair. And then it got patented in Canada and the US. All right, let's get into the talk. I like telling people up front what the take-home message is. And so I have three things that I want you to leave today's presentation with. The first one is EBM rocks. I mean, once you get a real taste for evidence-based medicine, it's hard to go back and practice any other kind of medicine. The second thing is the EBM answer is it all depends. And that's Dr. Andrew Worster, my EBM mentor. He's at a McMaster University. And he taught me that when it comes to some question in medicine, the answer is it all depends. So when I'm teaching medical students and residents, if they're functioning like at that really high level, they know that I want to hear the answer. I don't know, Ken, it all depends. Give me more context. It's not just about the literature. And often decisions are on a spectrum, and rarely is it simply a dichotomous answer. And of course, finally, be skeptical of everything, even of me. It doesn't mean that you're closed-minded, a nihilist, but rather you should be very open-minded, just not so open your brain falls out. The time to believe something is when there's sufficient evidence. Here are the objectives for today's lecture. I want to go through these five things. I want to talk philosophically about what is science and go through some of the key elements of science, talk about the burden of proof and who has the burden of proof and what do we do with the null hypothesis, and then talk about evidence-based medicine. We are going to have some practical aspects. I'm going to talk about critical appraisal and walk you through a process of how you can critically appraise the literature. And in this case, we'll just be talking about a randomized control trial. And then finally, I want to bring it back to something really relevant right now, a little bit about COVID-19. I don't want to give you too much because I know lately it's been like drinking from a fire hose with all the information that comes flooding into your inbox. So just a little bit about COVID-19. So let's start with, what is science? Well, science is the most reliable method for exploring the natural world. There are some qualities to science, like it's iterative, it can be falsified, it's self-correcting, and it should be proportional to the evidence. What it isn't is certain. We can have confidence around a point estimate of an observed effect size, and our confidence should be in part proportional to the strength of the evidence. But science doesn't make any claims about the truth. Scientists, however, do make mistakes, They're flawed individuals, just like the rest of us, and they're susceptible to cognitive biases. So are we a scientist? Are we physicians? Are we both? Well, physicians actually took on the image of a scientist by co-opting the white coat. There are a whole bunch of physicians wearing white coats and the stethoscopes, although the stethoscope seems to be going out of fashion, more like bedside ultrasound now. But we co-opted that white coat. Traditionally, actually, scientists wore a beige coat and physicians wore this black coat, this black robe, and it was to signify the somber nature of their work, sort of like the clergy. And then came the germ theory of disease and a whole bunch of other scientific knowledge during the scientific revolution. And it was back in 1910, the Flexner Report came out that really fundamentally changed medical education and improved the standards significantly in the United States. You know, you could get a medical degree back at the turn of the last century in just 1 year. The white coat, though, now symbolizes a scientific rigor that physicians, medical doctors are supposed to have, separating us from snake oil salesmen. Now, lots of medical schools still have white coat ceremonies, like Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry. However, only 1 out of 8 physicians still report wearing a white lab coat. So I think physicians are both scientists and physicians, and we should be. But science is usually iterative. Sometimes it takes giant leaps forward, but usually it's like baby steps. Now, you've probably heard the phrase standing on the shoulders of giants. The picture on the left is derived from Greek mythology, and that's the blind giant Orion. And Orion has his servant standing on his shoulders called Cetalion. Now, Cetalion on his shoulders was to act as the giant's eyes because the giant Orion was blind. Now, in the middle, you see Isaac Newton, and I'm sure you're familiar with this term. Quote, if I've seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Now, this is an interesting story, actually, because it was thought that Newton was throwing some shade on Robert Hooke over there on the right. Now, Robert Hooke was the first head of the Royal Society in England, and Hooke was described as being a small man, somewhat kyphotic, and not very attractive looking. Now, we don't actually know what Hooke looks like because there's no portraits of Hooke. So that picture is from descriptions. Now, Newton has been accused of throwing out Hooke's portrait when he became the head of the Royal Society and moved locations. Now, and the comments that Isaac Newton made about seeing farther, he was standing on the shoulders of giants, it was thought that that was a dig at Robert Hooke and his short stature and the famous rivalry between Newton and Hooke. However, you should be skeptical because this may be more gossip than truth, but standing on the shoulders of giants. So science is usually iterative. Now, I like to put this in a Canadian context. Here's a nice picture of fishing. You know, we tend to nudge around the edges in Canada. We explore the nooks and crannies, looking for that next iterative stage in discovering something. We paddle around, we drop a line in, we test a spot to see if we get any hits, and then we move on. It usually doesn't come in big bangs, like throwing a stick of dynamite into the water, exploding, and seeing which fish rise to the top. Science is also falsifiable. If it's not falsifiable, it's outside the real realm and domain of science. This philosophy of science was put forth by Karl Popper back in 1934. And a great example of falsifiability is the claim that all swans are white. The person making the claim has the burden of proof to show that all swans are white. But it's generally good to avoid claims that have absolutes like all and never. They can burn you. It only takes one black swan to disprove the claim that all swans are white. So I would encourage you to be careful when talking to your colleagues and to your patients about making medical claims and using terms like, well, it's always like this, or patients never have this. Those statements can really come back and bite you in the buttocks. Another part of science I just want to discuss is about proportionality. The evidence required to accept some claim should be in part proportional to the claim itself. The classic example was given by the famous scientist Carl Sagan, who did the TV series Cosmos and wrote a number of popular science books. Sagan made the claim that there was a fire-breathing dragon that lives in his garage. And that's why I have this image of this dragon. How much evidence would it take for you to accept the claim? His words? Pictures of a dragon? Videos of a dragon in his garage? Bones? Other biological evidence? How about some Bayesian thinking? How about your pretest probability that there is a fire-breathing dragon based on your experience with dragons? Have experience with other dragons? Do they breathe fire? So from a Bayesian perspective, what's the pretest probability that Carl Sagan really did have a fire-breathing dragon in his garage? Now, to contrast that with proportionality with regards to the claim and the evidence, what if I said, we're getting a new puppy? Unfortunately, we had to put our dog down this summer, and so we've been looking at getting a new puppy, and now it's out in the garage. How much evidence would I have to provide to convince you that I do have a puppy in my garage? You'd probably take my word for it. There's nothing extraordinary about the claim. Most of you should have some experience with puppies in the past. So the quality of the evidence to convince you of something should be at least proportional to the claim that's being asserted. The summary that Carl Sagan made was, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And because science is iterative, it's falsifiable, it's also self-correcting. Science gets updated. We hopefully learn and get closer to the truth over time. Medical reversal is a thing. And there's this great book that I would encourage you reading called Ending Medical Reversal. There are so many examples in medicine of medical reversal. We thought something made sense. There was biological, physiological reasons why steroids should have worked in that condition. And yet when they actually go out and do a proper randomized control trial, it didn't work. So the body's usually more complicated than we think. And so we have to be iterative. We have to change our mind when new evidence is presented to us. And I have mentioned the word truth, but speaking of truth, science really doesn't make any claims about the truth. It gives an approximation of an observed effect with a confidence interval around the point estimate of that effect. Science itself doesn't have any agency, but rather it's a process. However, scientists, like I said, are flawed individuals who do make mistakes. So finally, let's just talk about the burden of proof in this section. Who has the burden of proof? Well, it's those making the claim. And so we're going to talk about some claims, and I want to get this idea of who has the burden of proof. It's called a burden, not because it's easy, but because it is hard. And in science, we start with a null hypothesis, typically that there is no superiority to the treatment or intervention that we're about to undertake. Then evidence needs to be presented to convince us to reject the null hypothesis and accept a superiority claim. Now, if the evidence is convincing, if the burden has been met, we should reject the null. Now, if the evidence is not convincing, we need to accept the null. But it's a logical fallacy to shift the burden of proof onto those who say they do not accept the claim. So when I say, no, I'm not convinced, that doesn't mean I have to prove something doesn't work or prove a negative. What the person who's making the claim is, they've accepted the burden of proof and they need to demonstrate that their claim is valid and true. And this is an important distinction in epistemology. But this has been really philosophical. This is a starting point about how we do science. and how as physicians, we should be scientists and have that maybe not physical white coat, but we should have that white coat mentality. So let's give you a real world example of some of the information I've presented so far. Probiotics have been promoted for acute gastroenteritis in children, and previous work in this area has described as being crappy. Technically, what they said is, quote, underpowered and had methodological problems related to the trial design and choice of appropriate endpoints, end of quote. But there was this study published in the New England Journal 2 years ago that looked at lactobacillus rhamnosus versus placebo for acute gastroenteritis in children. And in this study, they took children that were 3 months to 4 years of age. They got almost 1,000 children into this study, and they had to have acute gastroenteritis. The intervention was they took a probiotic twice a day for 5 days, and they compared that to a placebo. The result, the primary outcome, was no statistical difference between the two. Now, this is important. Can we say that probiotics don't work? No, we can't. That would shift the burden of proof onto us to say that probiotics don't work. What we can say is that there's not evidence that probiotics do work for a patient-oriented outcome, or what's referred to as a POO. And so we must accept the null hypothesis of no superiority. But we're only talking about this probiotic being tested. All we can say is Lactobacillus rhamnosus has not been shown to work. There may be other probiotics that do work, but the time to accept that claim is when it's been demonstrated with good evidence. Now, in this same issue of New England Journal of Medicine 2018, they had a similar trial looking at Lactobacillus rhamnosus, but they also looked at Lactobacillus helveticus, and they found the same thing. No superiority of these probiotics to placebo. Now, before I leave this gastroenteritis and probiotics slide, I should note there is some weak evidence for probiotics having efficacy in antibiotic-associated diarrhea. So I don't want people to walk away going, probiotics don't work. That's not the claim. The claim was that probiotics work for acute gastroenteritis in children. We do not have evidence of that, but we do have some weak evidence that they work for antibiotic-associated diarrhea. The bottom line is probiotics can't be routinely recommended this time for children with acute gastroenteritis. And so we're left with not knowing things, but that doesn't bother me. After 25 years of practice, and I'm sure Steve Wetmore can back me up, you know, we won't have all the answers. Sometimes we won't know what's going on, and that's okay. I'll have approximate answers, as Richard Feynman said. I'm not scared of the unknown, and it's okay to say, I don't know. I don't have 100% certainty about anything. That would be a logical fallacy or nirvana fallacy, but I do have degrees of certainty, degrees of confidence about various positions. So do probiotics work in children with, you know, acute gastroenteritis? I don't know, but the evidence suggests that it doesn't. All right, that's a little practical stuff. Now let's get back to some more philosophical stuff. And this is something that I really like to talk about a lot. And this is evidence-based medicine. And it was defined by Dr. David Sackett over 20 years ago. He defined evidence-based medicine as the conscientious, explicit, and judicious use of the current best evidence in making decisions about the care of individual patients. Now, I really like this definition, but I did tweak it a bit. You'll see in yellow, I've put shared, because I think we should share our decisions with our patients in most situations. And each of these words is very, very important. We need to try to be conscientious about our decisions. We really need to be explicit, precise. Why are we doing it? What are we doing? And then judicious, we need to use our clinical judgment. Now, hopefully it's good clinical judgment. And then we need to look for the best evidence, not just any evidence that provides us with confirmation bias or agrees with our narrative, the best evidence. And I do encourage shared decision-making with our patients and find out about their values and their preferences. And it is about individual patient care. Studies are done on large populations, sometimes not very large, but certainly larger than an N of one usually. Unless you're in public health, you're treating people one at a time. So individual patient care. And here's a Venn diagram that represents that EBM definition. And the literature down there on the bottom is in blue. And the literature should inform our care. It should guide our care, but it shouldn't dictate our care. It's not a thou shalt do this. You still need to use that green circle, your good clinical judgment. Interpret the literature, apply the literature in your clinical setting. And then, of course, you need to turn to the patient and ask them, what do they value? What are their preferences? And you know the easiest way to find out what patients prefer and value? And I'm just spitballing here. Ask them. Actually explicitly ask them. So I've updated that Venn diagram that Sackett had been made back in 1996. And this is a modified version of that EBM Venn diagram. Now look at that bottom blue circle again. Many people make the mistake of thinking that evidence-based medicine is all about the scientific literature. This is not true. You need to know what the literature says, but again, it doesn't dictate your care. If it did, you wouldn't need a clinician. You wouldn't need the art of medicine. Your experience is very important. Sometimes we'll have lots of clinical experience in managing somebody. Other times, that Venn diagram, that circle, might be a bit smaller because we don't have much clinical experience on that condition. And of course, that other circle with all the patients in it, it starts with patient care and it ends with patient care. And we all want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence. So these three components make up EBM: the literature, our judgment, and patients' values and preferences. There is a hierarchy to the level of evidence. And like I said before, we want the best evidence, and it's usually described as the perfect pyramid, but I like this stack of rocks better because they're flawed, they're uneven, and it's not this perfect pyramid. The lowest form of evidence with the most bias is expert opinion. We have so many cognitive biases. Richard Feynman said, we shouldn't fool ourselves or you shouldn't be fooled, and we're the easiest person to fool. So we've got to be careful about expert opinion. In the middle there is randomized control trials. That's not the top. That's in the middle of this hierarchy of evidence. And then at the top, you have systematic reviews. However, I would like to caution you that I would take a well-designed randomized control trial than a crappy systematic review. There is actually a study that's higher, considered a higher level of evidence, and that is a randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled crossover trial with an N of one. Because again, we treat people one at a time. We don't treat populations usually, and we want to know if it works in that patient, not in all patients. Now, this next slide is about systematic reviews and meta-analysis and the concept of GIGO. That stands for garbage in, garbage out. What that means is that if you take a whole bunch of crappy little studies and mash them all up into a meat grinder and it spits out a point estimate down to the fifth decimal place and gives you some impressive p-value, that's only an illusion of certainty when certainty does not exist. It's some mathematical concept, but you've got to look at the original ingredients, i.e. what went into that systematic review. How good were the included studies? And I like to give an example of an apple pie. I grew up on an apple farm, just about a half an hour outside of Western. And on that apple farm, my mom's apple pie were the best apple pies ever. This is because she used wonderful ingredients with crisp, tart, fresh apples that we had just picked, unrefined sugar, cinnamon. And of course, they were all baked with love. But if you take an apple pie and all those wonderful ingredients, and add a kale pie. And that's the image on the left. It's something that comes out of the back of a cow. It lands on the ground, goes plop, and it's about the size of a pie. Now, if you take that cow pie and add it to an apple pie, it doesn't make the apple pie taste any better. All you get is a poop emoji. So this really drills down into, be cautious with saying, oh, well, there's a systematic review meta-analysis on that, and look at the p-value and look at that point estimate of effect size. Unless you've actually done a quality assessment and critically appraised that systematic review and checked for the quality of the ingredients, the original trials, if you have a whole bunch of observational studies, and I just got one yesterday, a systematic review, 1/3 of the studies were preprints on COVID. Preprints. They haven't been peer reviewed. And we know how many of those have been retracted, even once they get published in large peer reviewed, high impact journals. This COVID times, they get retracted. So be very careful about the ingredients. But there are some arguments against evidence-based medicine, and I'm going to go through a few of those quickly. One of the first arguments that people talk about is the parachute trial, and they're referring to, you can't do a randomized control trial on something involving harm. And then in the middle, you have the, nope, not going to believe it. Most research findings are false. The third thing is evidence-based medicine has been referred to as cookbook medicine, but that ignores the clinical judgment and the patient's values and preferences. It just focuses on the literature. And then while we have good evidence, some people don't accept it, and they say, talk to the hand. I'm just going to ignore it. And the final thing, and the fifth thing, and there are more than five things that people argue against evidence-based medicine, but I thought this one would be really good for busy family doctors, is we're just too damn busy. Really? You expect me to practice evidence-based medicine? I'll talk about that a little bit more. So the first thing, the argument against evidence-based medicine, is about the harm. It would be unethical to do a randomized control trial involving harm. The classic example given is the parachute trial, but you could say, yeah, we don't have any good evidence that giving antibiotics early to somebody with meningitis has been shown to be beneficial. Do you really think the ethics board would approve giving antibiotics within 6 hours once you have the diagnosis of meningitis? Clearly, it would involve harm. So the parachute trial back in 2003 was a systematic review and meta-analysis of randomized control trials looking at parachutes to prevent orthopedic injuries, head and soft tissue injuries, and mortality after a gravitational challenge, i.e. jumping out of an airplane. Now, when they searched the world's literature, and this is what, you know, systematic reviews do, you'll see, we searched the world's literature. They found no randomized control trials to back up their claim that parachutes would prevent major traumatic injuries and mortality. Now, they did find observational data. There were case reports of people free falling out of an airplane, the parachute didn't work, and they didn't die. There's also case reports and observational studies of people wearing a parachute and having iatrogenic injuries, either breaking an ankle, a pelvis, or even mortality. So they said, we do not have convincing evidence to support parachute wearing. So Smith and Pell made a proposal. They suggested taking all people like me who advocate for evidence-based medicine up in a plane, and they would randomize us into wearing a parachute or a sham parachute, which would be a backpack, and we would jump out of the plane. But to make this study more rigorous, anybody who survived the first jump, because there are observational data, like I said, both ways, they would do a crossover trial. If you survive the first jump, they said, okay, back up in the plane and you'd be randomized into the other group. And then we would have definitive evidence that parachutes prevent major morbidity and also mortality. Now, of course, the laws of physics, and laws are descriptive in physics about gravity. We understand gravity really, really well. Okay. So Hayes et al. In CMAJ came out and said, you know what? This whole parachute argument really doesn't hold a lot of water because most medical practices are not parachutes. And we can investigate whether or not something works. And it doesn't put people in harm's way. there usually is equipoise to the question we're asking. And here we are 15 years later in 2018, the parachute trial was conducted. We now have in the world's literature one randomized control trial of parachutes versus backpacks. So this study approached 92 passengers in a plane. They had to be 18 years of age and older. 23 agreed to participate. I don't know, would you agree to participate and jump out of a plane with a parachute or a backpack? The intervention was the parachute, the sham was the backpack, and their outcome was a composite outcome of death or major traumatic injury. The result from this trial was that parachutes did not, and I will repeat, did not reduce death or major injury. It was 0% in the intervention group and 0% in the control group with a p-value of greater than 0.9. Very impressive results, very convincing. Now, how did that happen? Well, there's a difference. You know, they approached 92 passengers, but only 23 agreed to be in it. There was a difference between participants and non-participants. Participants in the trial jumped at an average height of 0.6 meters at a speed of 0 kilometers an hour. In other words, the plane was on the ground and not moving. Those who decided not to participate were traveling at an average height of 9,000 meters and 800 kilometers an hour. So the details matter. Another argument against evidence-based medicine is most research findings are false. And this was done by John Ioannidis. And he's one of the most cited scientists across all the scientific literature. And this paper was published in the PLOS in 2005. And I would encourage you to read it. It's one of the top most cited articles in PubMed. It's a great paper. And if you read it, you'll understand why most public research findings are false. Scientists are often asking the wrong question, using the wrong methods, or using the wrong ways to probe their results and then interpret their results. So most research findings are false. Another argument against evidence-based medicine is that it's referred to as cookbook medicine. But again, this just focuses on the literature, and this is one of the most common mistakes and misperceptions about evidence-based medicine. And if you think about it as a cook, those great chefs out there, sure, they may follow a recipe, but they also follow their clinical judgment and experience and what they have at hand. And that's how they make amazing dishes. It's not following some cookbook. They still have to bring themselves into the process and bring their own clinical experience and judgment. And they also need to ask the person who's going to be eating what they cook, what would they value? What would they prefer? And so evidence-based medicine is more than just reading a cookbook. But evidence-based medicine is ignored. And this is a fourth argument against EBM. I like using antibiotics and antibiotic prescribing as the example, and this is a good time of year for that. When you look at children, the most common reasons for antibiotics that are inappropriately prescribed is acute otitis media. And I know the staff and the residents will know that there's good evidence, multiple lines of evidence, that 85% of otherwise healthy children over the age of 2 will spontaneously resolve their acute otitis media in 48 to 72 hours without antibiotics. Yet it's the most common reasons antibiotics are inappropriately prescribed in children. The evidence, the good evidence, is ignored. And in adults, the most common inappropriate reason for antibiotics is bronchitis. And we know bronchitis is 90% viral. And even if we get that 1 in 10 person who has a bacterial bronchitis, we actually don't have really convincing evidence that giving antibiotics has a clinically significant impact on the disease course. So if we have good evidence, yeah, we ignore it. And then the final one is, I have no time. Really? I mean, there are 4,000 medical publications every day. 75 randomized control trials are published every day in medicine. 11 systematic reviews and meta-analysis in medicine are published every day. You're going to be so far behind on Thursday. And that was before COVID. I mean, COVID has just exploded the amount of literature. How can you possibly keep up on all the literature? See patients and do shared decision-making with the pressure of administration, bookings, fit-ins. It's just not reasonable. But I would suggest that once you realize that most published research findings are false, effect sizes are usually small, and that engaging with patients, listening to patients, asking them about their values and preferences, it creates a much richer clinical experience, and you can actually be more productive practicing evidence-based medicine. But obviously, I'm an advocate for evidence-based medicine, but I'd like to give you, based on informed decision-making, some alternatives to consider. So, five alternatives to evidence-based medicine. This was adapted by Isaac and Fitzgerald. One of the alternatives to evidence-based medicine is eminence-based medicine. And this is your more senior colleague. And your more senior colleague puts less emphasis as placed on things like, you know, evidence. Experience, it seems, is worth any amount of evidence. And these colleagues have a faith in clinical experience, which has been described as making the same mistake with increasing confidence over an impressive number of years. And the eminent physician usually has white hair and a little balding patch, which is referred to as the halo effect. So that's eminence-based medicine. Do it because I said so. Then there's vehemence-based medicine, VBM, and this is where you substitute volume of evidence. In other words, you try to convince your colleagues or patients with the quantity of evidence as opposed to the quality of evidence. And this gets back to the crappy little study idea, garbage in, garbage out, and systematic reviews. A good randomized control trial is better than a crappy systematic review and meta-analysis with 100,000 patients with lousy methods and will usually not provide any useful information. Another alternative is elegance-based medicine. And this is the person who has the year-round suntan, the physician who comes in with the Armani suit from flying to Hawaii on, you know, big pharma, pocket handkerchief, a tongue that is as silky smooth as his tie, and the satirical and verbal eloquence. That shouldn't be any substitute for high-quality, clinically relevant evidence demonstrating patient-oriented outcome. In other words, it's about the evidence, not who's presenting the evidence. And then we have nervous-based medicine, that's NBN, and that's the fear of litigation. And this is a powerful stimulus to over-investigate and over-treat. And in an atmosphere of litigation phobia or shame and blame, the only bad test is the test you didn't think of ordering. And then finally, the fifth alternative to evidence-based medicine, that's CBM. This is not the competency-based medicine. No, this is confidence-based medicine, but it's usually restricted only to surgeons. All right, EBM, it's the worst form of practice of medicine, except all the others that have been tried. All right, so let's just go through a five-step critical appraisal so you'll have some practical applications here. How do you approach the literature in five EV steps? Well, you start with a PICO. That's step one, the population, the intervention, the control, and the outcome. So you've got to find the right population. If you're looking at something, you've got to make sure that it's looking at the patients you're interested in. So if you're asking the question, does a patient with Bell's palsy, a 72-year-old man standing up front with the red shirt there, if he comes in with Bell palsy, do antivirals work? Well, you better make sure the population wasn't a pediatric population and that the patients actually had Bell palsy. And then, of course, the intervention, that's what the I stands for. You want to find a double-blinded, hopefully placebo-controlled, randomized trial that looks at Bell palsy comparing antivirals to something. And that's the comparison or the control. And you want to see, is it a placebo-controlled? Is it compared to usual care for Bell palsy, like steroids? Is there no comparison? Do they put up a straw man? And then, of course, growing up on a farm, you want to look at those outcomes. Are they disease-oriented, a doo-doo? Are they lab-oriented, a loo, like viral load? Are they a
monitor-oriented outcome?
Let's hook up some EMGs on a patient with Bell palsy and see if there's some statistical difference in how fast the EMG transmits across the facial muscle. Or a poo, a patient-oriented outcome. Cosmesis, function, both? I don't know, ask the patient. Step two is you got to search for the best literature. Dr. Google is not a good place to go. Even Google Scholar can get you tens of thousands of hits when you're looking for Bell palsy. And PubMed, 1,500 hits when I looked up Bell palsy the other day. On the right, there are some good search engines that I would suggest. One of them is called Trip Database, or Turning Research into Practice. Another one is the Cochrane Database of Systematic Reviews and Meta-Analyses. And if you want to get uber nerdy, you can go to clinicaltrials.gov and even look for unpublished work. Oh yes, Nerdvana. Then you've got to find the least biased. And there's that evidence-based medicine pyramid that looks so crisp and clean, unlike that rocks, stack of rocks that I gave you. But down there on the bottom, you can see that lowest level of evidence, that nerd telling you. And then up at the top is the Cochrane collaboration as an example of a systematic review. And then you've got to do step four, and that's critically appraise the literature. And I've put up a website from the Center of Evidence-Based Medicine, and there are various checklists that you can go through for randomized control trials, observational trials, systematic reviews, clinical decision instruments, and go check, 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 yes, no, or unsure when reviewing a paper. And you know how you get really good at this? Practice, practice, practice. And step five, this is the last part, the end, when you're looking at the evidence and you've critically appraised it and you've considered some of the limitations, you'll have to decide if the information is practice changing. Did the evidence meet the burden of proof? Let's say for adopting antivirals for treating Bell palsy in your practice. That's the NNT at the bottom, the number needed to treat and the number needed to harm. And that's a nice way to summarize the data usually and present it to patients so that they can understand. All right, we're coming into the home stretch here, Steve. These are the last few slides. COVID-19. I couldn't give a presentation in October 2020 without talking about COVID-19, something very clinically relevant, talking about our approach to science, burden of proof, when to accept claims, and how to apply the literature. And COVID-19 has really tested our ability to be rational, to be scientists, and to be clinicians. And we need evidence-based medicine more than ever now. This is my interpretation of what's happened with COVID in a bit of a dumpster fire. I mean, look at the messaging on masking and how confusing it's been for clinicians and for the public. And don't get me started on social distancing. Every time I hear that, I just cringe. It's not social distancing. It's physical distancing. We need to stay socially connected. I'm so happy that Steve invited me to come and present at Rounds because this gives me an opportunity. Although we're not in the same room, I'm socially connecting with the faculty. I love it, but we're staying physically distant. And then the hydroxychloroquine studies, oh my goodness, all those observational studies and preprints and everybody's jumping on and going, okay, hydroxychloroquine. No, we didn't have good evidence that it worked. And then remdesivir, when it came out, people were practicing by press release. It was a press release for remdesivir prior to the actual publication, and people were doing it. And then most recently, convalescent plasma, getting an emergency authorization based on an observational study that wasn't even published yet. So an observational study that was miscommunicated saying that there is a decrease in death, not observed death, not an association of decreased death, but saying that it caused decrease in death. It didn't. There was an observational study saying there was an association in lower risk of death. And then they mixed up relative reduction with absolute reduction. Next up, we've got vaccines. We really need to get it right when it comes to vaccines. So to date, I think the whole COVID-19 and the communication of science, the implementation of science, the discussion of science, science communication, and in clinical practice has been a bit of a dumpster fire. So this is a good friend of mine. His name's Simon Carley, and he has a knowledge translation project called St. Emlyn's. And he wrote in the Journal of the BMJ back in July that we really need to talk about the urgency that COVID-19 represents, and that it represents a threat to evidence-based medicine, but also an opportunity. And they encourage critical reasoning, critical appraisal, and critical thinking during these COVID times. They finished their publication saying that we must use science and not let emotions politics, or economic issues interfere with the science, and that the principles of evidence-based medicine are more important now than ever in any time in our career. And I would echo that sentiment. So I gave you the take-home message at the front. The three things that I wanted you to remember is EBM rocks. I think it's the best way to practice medicine. I think it's extremely rewarding clinically. And I've shown you different alternatives and why I wouldn't use those, and talked about some of the limitations when it comes to evidence-based medicine. Also, we're going to have a question answer period after this. So be prepared for me to say, it all depends. And of course, I'm going to be skeptical of everything. And I would encourage you to have a healthy skepticism of everything, even if anything I told you today. So in conclusion, give a person a fish and you'll feed them for a day. Teach a person to fish and you will feed them for a lifetime. And so I've hopefully taught you how to fish, in other words, think, and not what to think, so that you can have an approach to family practice, healthy skepticism, and can critically appraise the literature. And you'll get better at critical appraisal and evidence-based medicine by practice, 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 with the ultimate goal of patients getting the best care based on the best evidence, because it starts with patient care and it ends with patient care. Thank you very much.
Ken, thank you so much for that really engaging romp through the history of science, evidence-based medicine, and all the way to dumpster fires. That was great, bringing the science back into acute care studies.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that presentation on how to think, not what to think. There is a YouTube video of the presentation that was given. And again, the slides are available for your favorite price, my favorite price, available FOMED. Yes, free open access to medical education. The SGEM will be back next episode doing a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year, using the power of social media, so patients get the best care based on the best evidence. And remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Talk to you next time.